Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yesterday in Denver, President Obama finally signed the stimulus bill. Roughly 20% of the money goes to health care, and it sets the terms for a gathering storm of debate over a massive overhaul.
We have done more in 30 days to advance the cause of health care reform than this country has done in an entire decade, and that's something we should be proud of.
Reform is in the air, and the president has promised to tackle health care with a new approach to getting spiraling costs under control. Is America ready? This hour On Point, the new groundwork for health care reform. You can join the conversation. What are you looking for in health care reform? What role should the government play in controlling costs? Joining me first from Danville, Pennsylvania, is Cece Connolly, reporter for The Washington Post. She covers health care. Cece, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Jane. Great to be with you.
Thank you. What is in the stimulus bill in terms of health care provisions?
Well, as you mentioned, quite a significant portion of this legislation is focused on health care. A couple of the very large ticket items. The first is $90 billion over the next couple of years that will go to states for the Medicaid program. That, of course, is health care for lower-income folks who can't afford insurance. And the states really desperately need that assistance because they're getting more and more people applying for that help at a time when they have less revenue. There's also about $25 billion for something that goes by the very odd name COBRA, but it is basically the insurance that people can purchase on their own when they've lost a job. And this is going to give folks about a 65% credit towards that insurance. It can be rather expensive to help them pay for it if they're in between jobs.
That's about for 7 million people that will help?
That's approximately 7 million people over a nine-month period.
There's also $19 billion in there to encourage what, the broader use of health information technology, electronic medical records and prescriptions, that sort of thing.
Exactly, and that's going to be going to doctors and hospitals, mainly in the form of incentives, paying them some smaller bonuses if they start using modern technology to write prescriptions, to keep track of people's medical records, et cetera. And interestingly, $10 billion got added very late in the negotiations by Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter for the National Institutes of Health. He has long been a big supporter of research and that research agency, and he was one of only three Republicans to vote for the bill, and he had that money added. And then there are a couple of smaller figures. There's about $1 billion in prevention money. Much of that will be for immunizations. Mm. And $1 billion for something called comparative effectiveness, which I know we're going to spend a little bit more time talking about in detail.
We just played a little of President Obama talking about advancing the cause of health care reform. What did this stimulus money set into motion?
Well, the stimulus money, and also I'm going to add in there, because I think that he would, a couple of things that happened even before the stimulus bill. Just a few weeks ago, Congress passed and President Obama signed an expansion of the Children's Health Insurance Program. That's going to ensure that about 11 million poor children get health insurance. It's about 4 million more than currently are covered. So the White House considers that an important part of its promise to extend health coverage to every single child in America. Some of the things that we then see in the stimulus package, when you look at something like money for prevention, or you look at that money for health insurance information technology, the computers and modernizing and going to electronic medical records, those are all things that the Obama administration and many in Congress say take those first steps toward a much bigger health reform effort that they hope will follow later this year.
So this is really just the first step in momentum toward broader, bigger issues upcoming.
That's certainly their hope and their intention, that sometimes you hear the phrase, these are down payments on that larger agenda.
Cece, stay with us for a moment. I'd like to add another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Piscataway, New Jersey, is Mitchell Seltzer. He's a longtime hospital consultant who founded the firm Seltzer Reese. He's been doing some pioneering studies comparing health care treatment costs, and his clients include community hospitals across the country and many of the big academic institutions, including Harvard, Penn, Chicago, California, and the Mayo Clinic. He has the ear of Peter Orszag, President Obama's budget director, and the stimulus package, as Cece mentioned, has more than $1 billion to start comparing the cost and effectiveness of treatments across this country. So his ideas are going places. Mitchell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jane. And hello, Cece.
Hello.
So, Mitchell, $1 billion for this so-called comparative effectiveness research. This is at the heart of the work that you've been doing for many years. Tell us exactly what it is.
Well, I think maybe the place to frame the issue to begin with is simply acknowledgement of the crisis. Medicare is going to be insolvent, if not absolutely bankrupt, in 120 months. And as Cece mentioned, Medicaid is pushing state budgets to insolvency. What is not generally talked about and is sort of a hidden issue behind the crisis is the variation in the way physicians practice. There are probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 750,000 practicing physicians in the country. Virtually every one of them manages their care differently. That variation in the way physicians care for their patients drives up the cost of health care by $150 billion a year in hospitals alone. And that same inconsistency, if you will, in the standards of care harms patients and sometimes kills them.
So you can't see the variation of care being explained by the health, the good health of the local population or the quality of the care that they receive?
No. If you take into consideration the condition of the patient, what explains the variation is the practice style of the physician. And what we've been focusing on, Jane, are a few straightforward questions. They're complicated, but they're pretty simple. And two or three of them: what can we identify physicians who are clinically effective and cost effective as well? Can we document exactly how they practice care? That is, how they use clinical resources to take care of their patients. And thirdly, can we use this knowledge to improve the standards of care that all patients receive, reduce costs, and reform care? Now, we've looked at the practice profiles of over 24,000 physicians, and those physicians have treated 1.5 million patients among them. And we've reached four rather startling conclusions, and I think it's these conclusions that have struck Peter and other people in the administration as the opportunity to revolutionize the way care is practiced and paid for.
So what's the headline conclusion?
Well, the headline conclusion are sort of four points. One, that there are physicians on every medical staff in this country who are able, with striking consistency, to admit a patient to a hospital, diagnose them, treat them, and discharge them using 20% to 30% fewer clinical resources per case. Secondly, and this may be one of the most unexpected conclusions, is that the efficient physicians actually, by and large, produce better care. Their patients are exposed to fewer errors. They acquire fewer hospital infections. They have shorter stays in the hospital. They are readmitted less frequently. But in terms of mortality and death rates, the patients of physicians who have efficient practices, fewer of them die.
So let me make sure I get this. Doctors who spend more on extra tests or high-tech treatments don't necessarily get better results than their more conservative colleagues. In fact, patients of aggressive doctors stay sicker longer, maybe even die sooner because of invasive care? Is that what you're saying?
It's a great question, and it really goes to the heart of the issue. What this data does is flip that assumption completely on its head. And what we are able to conclude now is that efficiency really is quality. There is so much variation in the way resources are used that the effective and the efficient physicians are able to fundamentally focus on more precise and effective use of the resources that they do use. And that really brings us to maybe the most important application of the data in terms of policy and healthcare reform. And that is, if we now know how to identify physicians and services that provide the best care at the lowest cost, we can buy the best care at the lowest cost, and that's never been possible.
So Peter Orszag, the head of the White House Budget Office, is very interested in your work, as you mentioned. In our 30 seconds before the break here, what are you encouraging him big picture to think about as a concept toward moving healthcare in a different direction?
Purchasing more efficiently, quite simply. With the federal government spending, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 to $400 billion on hospital care alone, without any particular substantive means to increase the payments to hospitals, they have to get more for what they buy. They have to pay for value. And what this data makes possible is the purchase of care on the merit of the care that's being provided.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the groundwork that's been laid for healthcare reform, and you can join our conversation. How do you see the healthcare reform debate shaping up? We're joined this hour by Cece Connolly, reporter for The Washington Post, and Mitchell Seltzer, a hospital consultant whose pioneering work is influencing the White House's reform efforts. I'd like to listen to some sound now. During the House debate over the stimulus bill on Friday, Representative Wally Herger, Republican of California, railed against the health care cost studies that were put into motion by the congressional Democrats and President Obama.
I also want to call to attention a little-known provision tucked into six pages deep inside this 1,100-page bill. The Democrats are spending $1.1 billion on new federal board to conduct health care research. Sounds innocent enough, right? Unfortunately, this provision is the camel's nose under the tent in the Democrats' quest to have the federal government push doctors aside and put Washington in charge of patients' health treatment options.
Mr. Seltzer, a camel's nose under the tent of the Democrats' quest here?
I don't think so.
Well, tell us why you disagree.
Well, the greatest unused asset in healthcare is the clinical intelligence of the medical community. What this data does and what the administration, as I understand my conversations with them, does is fundamentally try look at and examine what are the best practices and how do we pay for them fairly. This has nothing to do with managing care. It has nothing to do with formulating protocol prescriptions for physicians. It says basically we know how to identify clinically effective and clinically efficient physicians and services. Let's pay for those rather than the inefficiency that's in the system.
Cece Connolly, chime in here. It seems lawmakers and lobbyists agree that comparing the clinical merits of different treatments is appropriate, but when you talk about cost and cost comparisons, it's much more difficult and clearly hotly debated.
Absolutely, Jane. You've put your finger on where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, in this debate, and we'll hear much more of it in the coming months. There's a fair amount of comparative effectiveness that is already taking place around our country in various healthcare arenas. There is an agency of the federal government known by its acronym ARC that already does conduct some of this research, some of it through grants. There are some centers around the country and certainly you have some innovative private plans, such as Kaiser out on the West Coast, mm-hmm. that does a fair amount when it tries to determine how it's going to treat certain conditions, which sorts of prescriptions it's going to give favorable treatment to. But the really dicey fight comes when you start using that information to make monetary decisions and to make coverage decisions. So that is what has led to some of the rhetoric, pretty red-hot rhetoric, using words such as rationing. And it's a little bit of a long way to go from doing some comparative effectiveness research to saying people's care may be rationed, but that is the stretch that's being made right now.
Mitchell Seltzer, will you ultimately be forced to put a price on treatments, and doesn't that by definition lead to rationing of care?
No, I don't think it leads to rationing at all. I mean, the hospital and the healthcare industry is one of the few in our economy that has never had to improve its productivity to survive. What this data allows us to look at is a way to improve clinical productivity, and that's never been possible. And so this isn't about rationing care. It isn't about putting limitations on payments. It's about identifying levels of efficiency that should be rewarded because they produce better care.
We heard the representative in the earlier sound from California referring to this government board, this 15-member panel that's going to be set up to study and compare these health care costs. Why is that necessary, Mitchell Seltzer?
Well, there needs – I don't know if it's necessary. I think it's conceptually a good idea. There needs to be a way to not just adjudicate but outline principles. There have been best practices and standards of care since Hippocrates, but this – what the variation shows is that by and large they've been ignored. There's never been a way to define them effectively so that they become common standards of care adopted by each institution and across hospitals. So I think if the federal board, if it becomes a reality, does its job effectively, it's only going to present guidelines for standards that everyone should be adhering to now and are not adhering to them.
C.C. Connolly, you hear Republican lawmakers, here's that word again, rationing, calling this board a government rationing board. Do we already have this sort of thing, though, set up for other means, for example, new medications and that sort of thing? It's not a new idea, per se.
Well, it's not a completely new concept. Certainly, the agency that oversees Medicare and Medicaid, for instance, makes coverage decisions all of the time. But I don't think you have had, especially in the government, the sort of very smart, sophisticated analysis that then leads to these decisions. I mean, maybe one way of thinking of it is turning the government and all of the rest of us into smarter, better informed healthcare consumers. You know, when you think about it right now, Jane, there may be two or three or four medications for any particular illness that you or a family member has, and it's very difficult to get neutral, unbiased, science-based information on that sort of thing. Or when you're thinking about maybe a surgical procedure, or you're thinking about whether or not you want to have surgery for back pain or you want to try physical therapy. So these are the kinds of decisions that get made in healthcare every single day by consumers, by doctors, by hospitals. And this whole idea is to bring some reasonable, rational, systematic analysis to that decision making. It's certainly not going to be perfect, and there will be winners and losers down the road. There will be individual hospitals, and there will be doctors who will not necessarily fare well under this kind of scrutiny. But ultimately, the hope is that it can lead to better, more efficient health care.
The computerizing of medical records, I know, plays into this quite significantly. Mitchell Seltzer, can you explain to us why?
Well, it gives everybody access, clearly, to common data. And I think it's important, though, and CeCe may want to comment on this, the organizing of the data, the technology of an electronic medical record or physician order entry is important, but that doesn't get at necessarily how to define and identify what is effective and efficient practices. And that's the data that will, in effect, be loaded into the electronic medical record and physician order entry in order to allow people to scrutinize and compare the practices from one physician to another, from one service to another, from one hospital to another. And if that's called rationalizing or rationalizing the decision-making process, as some people are labeling it, fair enough. But it really allows, as CeCe was suggesting, a level of medical consumerism that's never been possible.
After the medical records are computerized and national data is analyzed, if it gets to that, in many ways that's the easy part, because then you have to step in and decide about reimbursement. And I'm curious about insurance companies under this proposal, under this plan, how necessarily things would change for them, CeCe Connolly.
Well, more than likely you'll see these things begin with Medicare, and the reason for that is the government pays for those health care purchases for about 43 million individuals. So the government becomes a very influential purchaser, and we have seen time and time again that once a decision is made by Medicare about whether or not, for instance, to cover bariatric surgery, generally then the private insurers will follow suit, follow those guidelines. So for many reasons, we anticipate that more of these changes will begin within the Medicare program and follow. Interestingly, though, there are some innovative things going on out in the country right now. The reason that I'm in Danville, Pennsylvania right now and not Washington is I have been visiting a place called Geisinger Health Systems, which is really doing some very unusual cutting-edge things around trying to improve the quality of care that it does and lower things like errors, lower infection rates, lower complications, and actually start locking in some set fees for different procedures and treatments and therapies. So you can find these pockets of innovation around the country, and I would suspect that if Congress can move forward on this front, you'll see more and more of those experiments encouraged.
I've got calls lined up around the block here. I'd like to get some listeners into this conversation. First, to the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia. Roberta is on the line. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Yes.
I'll try and be concise. I have two comments. One is that about using automation, and my concern is that I came to work in this area recently. I've been a nurse for over 40 years, and local hospitals, good hospitals, I'm not complaining about the hospital at all, but good hospitals, try to automate it. And basically, I know they spent a fortune, and they simply automated their bureaucracy, which isn't helpful. And I don't know, and that concerns me about this money, that if it's given to automate, the instinct is to automate into what you know. And these bureaucracies, they're not, I'm not saying anything against the hospitals or the doctors. They're good hospitals, good doctors.
Yeah, but as you say, they automated bureaucracy. Mitchell Seltzer, will you respond to that?
Well, I think that's a fair concern. On the other hand, we want to facilitate decision making. And if physicians are going to have to finally be the ones who decide how to change the way they care for patients, they have to have rapid access to the best possible information, both clinical and financial. There are hospitals all over this country, medical centers all over this country, spending hundreds of millions of dollars of their own capital to improve electronic medical records and technology. But ultimately, the most expensive cost in medicine is the pen of a physician. Physicians, when they write an order, those orders are incontrovertible. And so ultimately what we have to do to lower the cost of healthcare is to get physicians to write more efficient orders. And that prerogative is theirs. We have to facilitate that decision-making process, not only with information technology, but with evidence of better care. And those technologies are going to include access to that evidence more readily.
C.C. Connolly, based on what Mitchell Seltzer just said, what's the response? I mean, how do doctors fall into all this? Doctors who say, I want to have the ability to order the tests that I need or think are appropriate for my patient. How do you appease the doctors in this process?
Well, and not going to be easy. I have written about stories in places where doctors have just absolutely revolted and refused to change and use electronic medical records. One of my doctors has said that she would be more inclined to retire than have to make that switch. So you certainly do see that attitude. On the other hand, in the places that I have been to where you see a very good, robust electronic medical record, and everyone, doctors, nurses, physician assistants, and I would add the patient having access to a lot of this information, it's generally because all of those people were involved in the development of the system so that you can have nurses on the floor, such as Roberta, saying, hey, hang on a second, this doesn't make sense to have these extra steps, you know, built into the computer system. We need to streamline it, or we need to have these reminders for this type of patient. In the good ones, what you'll see is that it almost serves as a good safety reminder system. Think a little bit about airline pilots, and when they get into the cockpit, every single time they go through a checklist. And it's not because they don't know how to fly an airplane, and it's not because some of them might be asked, heaven forbid, to someday land on the Hudson River. We still want them to have that kind of skill, just like we want our doctors to have their brilliant knowledge and expertise. But it's a reminder list.
Here's another call before our next break. Tom is in Westchester, New York. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the program, and thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick comment after what I just heard and then a quick question. One is that I thought it was interesting, and I'm not surprised that there would be a lot of doctors resisting this or wanting to retire. My personal view on that is let them retire. I feel like there needs to be a new attitude and a new generation of thinking about how to do this stuff. And if those folks who want to stay in the old school want to, then they should. So that was my comment. Then the question is this, is I was hoping that Mitchell and Cece could be a little clearer on this point of efficiency versus less care or rationed care, because my understanding, maybe I'm getting this wrong, is that efficiency means that the physician can use less resources as long as they're using the right resources. And if they're not, then we're just basically trying to cut costs, and that brings us back to the old days of managed care, where costs are being controlled, but outcomes are not so good.
Tom, thank you. Mitchell Seltzer, in 30 seconds before our break, could you answer quickly?
Sure. The caller puts his finger on exactly the right perspective, and it's right resources. There are physicians who are strikingly, as we said earlier, strikingly able to manage their patients with a high level of efficiency because their experience, their training, their collegial environment, their acculturation to medicine, their time in the field has enabled them to use resources more precisely. Once we understand how to define their practice style, their practice approach to caring for medical problems or surgical procedures, other physicians can peer review those and adopt those practices.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about healthcare reform and the new government effort to rein in costs. We're joined this hour by C.C. Connolly, reporter for The Washington Post, and Mitchell Seltzer, a hospital consultant whose pioneering work is influencing the White House's reform efforts. Let's get right back to the phones now, first to Bob in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wondered if we need to reinvent the wheel here. There have been recent studies about the European plans of health care, the national plans, and I'm just wondering if we may be able to learn something from them. The recent studies have shown that most of the fears and and canards put out by the conservatives are not really true, that efficient medical care at fairly decent cost ratios is delivered by France, I think, Sweden. And I'm, as a follow-up to that, I'm just wondering, do we have the political will as a country to do this right now, any kind of massive reform, or are we going to need another election cycle where we're going to have a filibuster-proof Senate?
Mm. Bob, thanks so much. First point to you, Mitchell Seltzer, the European model of health care. What can we learn from it? What do you think?
Well, we may reach a point where we have a single-payer system, but at the moment, I don't know if that's necessarily feasible from a political point of view. What we need to reinvent is what we pay for. And let me just put that quickly into a couple of contexts. If Medicare today, tomorrow morning, purchased care from the efficient providers of care, it would save $25 billion annually. If Detroit and its bailout issues purchased health benefits for the UAW workers, current and retired, it would save the health benefits and drop the cost of Detroit cars by roughly $750 to $1,000 apiece. Mm. And that's what we've never had access to before. How do we evaluate the value, in effect, of what we're purchasing? And that's what's revolutionizing the thinking in Washington, not any desire to get the government involved by managing it, but to enlighten the purchasing of care so that we have more effective and efficient results.
Cece Connolly, to you for the caller's second point, Bob's second point about the political will in Washington. Help us understand how that ground is shifting in Washington. Tom Daschle, the president's choice to head up health care, no longer around. I mean, where do we stand?
Right. I think Bob's question is fantastic. And the political will, we don't know yet. Already, observers have been saying that given the near party line vote on this stimulus package, given the near party line votes on that children's health insurance program, there hasn't been tons of optimism that this idea of bipartisan effort on healthcare reform, it's early yet and much can change. And there is one school of thought that the worsening of the economy, which will naturally mean more people struggling with healthcare costs, could in fact provide something of a political boost for healthcare reform. More and more people are going to be feeling that squeeze, as well as businesses, which pay a large percentage of our healthcare costs. All of that said, you mentioned Tom Daschle, who of course had been President Obama's choice to run the Department of Health and Human Services, as well as be something of a White House healthcare czar. And he really had a unique skill set for the job. He not only understood healthcare policy, but as a longtime former senator, Senate Majority Leader for a period of years, everyone expected that he was going to have some great expertise when it came to really working out deals in Washington and getting everyone on board with some kind of an effort. They have yet to find a replacement for him. It has pushed back many of the early efforts that had started even before Inauguration Day. Things have really stalled on the healthcare front in Washington, and they're going to need some fresh energy to get things back on track. Mm-hmm.
Pick up on that point and to refer to something you said earlier, Cece. Mitchell Seltzer, Peter Orszag at the White House Budget Office has been arguing that tackling health care reform is the ultimate solution to cutting the budget in this economic crisis. In other words, the bad economic time shouldn't take reform off the table. In fact, maybe make it more pressing. Is that true?
I think it is true, and I think Peter's absolutely right. Peter's an economist. He's studied healthcare for a couple of decades himself, and he really understands the economics. And let's just frame that again in terms of reform. When physicians write orders, they drive 80% of the expense structure of a hospital. So if we can provide them with evidence of more efficient ways to approach care, and they write fewer orders for the clinical resources that are used in that care, costs drop immediately, and hospitals survive. Patients get more consistent institutional standards of care. That's what Peter's focusing on. And I think Cece's absolutely right. The loss of Daschle is a blow for all the reasons she said. But he's not pivotal. The focus is going to be on making Medicare more effective. And as I guess Cece also said earlier, when Medicare makes a decision, most of the industry follows. That's what happened in 1965 when Medicare was created and created the prospective payment system. The industry followed all but the next day.
Back to the phones. Vicki is in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Hi, Vicki. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for waiting.
I have been an internist for over 20 years, and I believe very strongly that until there is malpractice tort reform, the cost of health care will never go down. Mm. A patient can come in for an $80 to $100 office visit, and that office visit can turn into a $3,000 or $4,000 office visit because of tests that may be either demanded by the patient or ordered by the physician because of the fear of lawsuits.
Mm. Vicki, I'm curious. You say you're an internist, and we'll get to your malpractice tort question, reform question in a minute. But I'm curious, as a physician, what do you think about Mitchell Seltzer and what he's saying in this more efficient way for doctors to approach care? Does it sound to your mind appropriate, or do you think it's the government telling you what to do?
I think it's the I don't see any problem with the government necessarily helping with guidelines that make more sense from studies that have been done. But if you're going to ask us to order fewer tests and work more efficiently and spend less money, then you're going to have to protect us when the outcome is not perfect. Patients are extremely educated. They come in almost telling us sometimes what they need and what they want. Mm-hmm. And God forbid we don't do it. And if there's not a perfect outcome, I'm afraid to say we live in a very litigious society, and doctors are very afraid. I've seen several friends have their lives nearly ruined by frivolous lawsuits. Mm. And if you want us to change our practices, you're going to have to protect us.
Vicki, thank you. Cece Connolly, malpractice, tort reform. You hear the good doctor speaking of it firsthand.
Mm. Well, there's mixed data in terms of how much of an overall economic impact malpractice insurance and, more importantly, lawsuits actually have. We certainly hear about the big attention-getting jury decisions of huge numbers and the effect that that can have on the medical profession. But overall, there have been some studies that if you look at the $2.2 trillion that the United States now spends on healthcare, more per capita than any other country in the world, by the way, I think that a relatively small portion of that large sum of money is actually related to malpractice, either coverage or lawsuits. That said, the doctor gets at a very important point, which is that we consumers, we patients and future patients, and this is very much a part of the American psyche and the American culture, we want everything. We want the newest, latest, greatest, whatever we see advertised on television. And it will take a real change in this country to come around to the idea that maybe just because something is new, it may not necessarily be the best. Mm. Or just because there's a purple pill instead of a pink pill, and the purple pill costs twice as much, that it's necessarily better. So a part of this whole process is going to have to really be educating the consumers and patients about these sorts of things. Mm.
Another call here from Peggy. She's in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Hi, Peggy. Thank you for waiting, and welcome to On Point.
Hi. Yeah, I think 3 points. A few callers ago talked about other national programs, and an article in The New Yorker recently did a study and showed that every one of those programs grew out of something that was already there, that for one reason or another, they had some government involvement, and they turned that into a national program. So it makes sense to me to build on Medicare. I'm a Medicare recipient, mm-hmm. and I'm a Medicare provider. I'm a clinical social worker doing psychotherapy. And there are definitely problems with the bureaucracy. I currently am being asked to provide 20 different items on three different clients in order to justify the $37 that they pay me.
So what do you think about what Mitchell Seltzer is saying? Do you think, based on your experience, that a new system would work?
I think it would work if it's guidelines. My concern with that is that medicine, whether it's mental health or physical, is part science and part art, because you're working with people. Mm. And what works with one individual will not necessarily work as well with another individual, even though there's a study that shows that it worked with, you know, 5,000 people. Mm.
Peggy, so thanks so much for your call. My time is short. I appreciate you calling in. The caller leads me to a point that I've been thinking about Mitchell Seltzer, which is how does this plan a new plan that you're talking about, how might this plan affect Americans at different levels, those who don't have health insurance and those who perhaps have gold-plated employer plans, good insurance? Will those people see any changes?
Oh, I think everyone would see the same change, namely that they would know which physicians to turn to, which practices to ask for, which clinical services to seek out that provide the best care at the lowest cost. Again, Rand did a study a few years back. Cece may be familiar with it. You may as well, Jane, that said hospitalized patients receive the right treatment maybe 53% of the time. And what we're seeing now is that we now have a way, all of us, to define effective and efficient treatments that are clinically credible to the physicians. Remember, the physicians have to adopt these new practices. It's going to be very difficult to impose them. So I'm not at all leery about the concerns of cookbook medicine. I don't think that's going to happen. We simply have to provide care that definitions of care that physicians believe are in the best interests of their patient. And what we've seen, in truth, I mean, to take an optimistic point of view, is that physicians, by and large, will always try to do what's in the best interests of their patient. The definitions of clinical effectiveness and clinical efficiency that we're now looking at are credible to physicians. They're already adopting these practices. We have hospitals that are transforming their institutional standards of care based on a medical staff's enthusiasm for finding better ways to treat their patients.
Do you see that, Cece Connolly, in your reporting? The hospitals, are they eager for reform in large measure because of the economic crisis, or is it just the opposite?
I think that there are a handful around the United States that are absolute standout innovators and are very much showing the way for this kind of really revolution in our healthcare delivery system. But it all goes back to, I think, where we kind of started this conversation, which is what do doctors and hospitals get paid for? And right now they get paid per procedure, it's almost piecemeal work. It's insulting to think about this, but a doctor gets paid more for the more that he or she does to you, instead of getting paid for keeping you well and keeping you out of the hospital. They make money when you go in the hospital and when you have tests and when you have surgeries and when you have complications, not when they keep you home well and working. And that's what has to change.
Mitchell Seltzer, to wrap up here, there's so many issues associated with health care reform. And, you know, many people think about Hillary Clinton and what we went through just a few years ago in this vein. The partisanship, do you see it easing? Do you see what is success? What is the future and where are we going in the successful path to reform in healthcare system?
I do see it changing for reasons that we've all talked about. There's an economic imperative to change it. In the early 80s, there were 7,200 hospitals in the United States. Today, there are 5,000. They have either merged or gone out of business because they couldn't close the gap between their expense and their fixed prices that they receive from payers like Medicare. No, I see enormous reasons to be optimistic about medical consumerism, both on the provider side and the payer side. And people, at least that we're talking to, are on both sides of the aisle and in throughout the economy, are enormously optimistic about finding definitions of care that are credible to the payer, to the patient, to the provider, provider and to employers.
Cece Connolly, I'll give you the last word in the minute we have left here. How is this different from what we saw years ago with Hillary Clinton and her fight to change healthcare?
I think that the primary difference is the economic situation. By the time Bill Clinton entered office in early 1993, the economy was on the upswing. We don't see any sign of that right now, so there will continue to be all of these pressures brought to bear on the system. More and more people are going to feel this squeeze, and I think really you'll see increased demand for improvement. That said, this will be a long, arduous process. None of these things will happen quickly. None of them will happen overnight. Just getting doctors to all use electronic medical records and then to get those records to talk to each other, that in and of itself will be a very big, tough step along the way. So it will take a while.
Well, my thanks to both of you and to the callers for this very interesting hour. Cece Connolly from The Washington Post joining us from Danville, Pennsylvania. My thanks to you, Cece, very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And Mitchell Seltzer, hospital consultant and founder of the firm Seltzer Reese, doing some comparative cost analysis and consulting with the White House on future health care reform. Mitchell Seltzer, thank you very much and good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners. Download our On Point podcast at the website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.